All right, so this also is work done in collaboration with Shane Larson, and it's a talk about the flying peanut, which we have there. We'll see what this flying peanut is later on. Okay, so what is the cosmic gravitational wave background? Well, how about we start with something that we do know something about and heard a lot about, the analog in microwaves of this, which is the cosmic microwave background. And this is giving us a picture of the universe at about 300,000 years AB after the Big Bang. And we all know what wonderful things we learned first from mapping out the anisotropies with COBE, and more recently with the smaller scale measurements like Boomerang, shown here, showing us that the universe looks like the curvature scale is outside the horizon, which cosmologists call flat. What we might forget, since in the last 10 years since COBE, everything we've been hearing about the CMB is how great it is to have a map of the anisotropies, and it would be wonderful to have a similar map of the cosmic gravitational wave background. But even if we couldn't get that, and that turns out to be very difficult, what we tend to forget is the most important thing that we learned from the cosmic microwave background was that it looks like this. That it's actually highly isotropic, right? That was actually probably one of the most important things that we learned from it. And the other very important thing was that it had this most perfect black body spectrum. So I would be very happy if we could see, even at like zeroth order, or sorry, like first order perhaps, that the gravitational wave background also showed a fair degree of isotropy. And I'd be very interested to learn what its spectrum looked like. It's very unlikely to look anything like this, because it's not going to be reprocessed in the same way that the scalar fluctuations were. So what is this cosmic gravitational wave background? Well, it's characterized, we're used to in gravitational wave physics talking in terms of things like the strains, or the strain spectral density, but we tend to do a conversion when working in terms of gravitational waves, and want to talk in terms of omega gravity wave, which is the energy density per logarithmic frequency in units of the critical density, I guess, something's not quite right here, of the how much they contribute to the total energy density of the universe per logarithmic frequency bin. And the conversion, if you want to get from this quantity to this quantity, which is what you will see in standard sort of plots of sensitivities, you need to multiply by the frequency to the 3/2 power, some conversion factors, and take the square root. Okay. Just a few things about it. The cosmic gravitational wave background is coming to us from the very beginning of the universe, and unlike the photons, we can't see through the plasma in the early universe and photons, so we're only seeing back to 300,000 years after the Big Bang. But in the gravitons just go straight through completely unharmed, so we'd actually have a picture of essentially the first fraction of a second of the universe. Exactly when they were produced depends on the theory, but it's well inside the first second. If you're working in the context of a standard sort of inflationary picture and not one of the more exotic models that people are talking about nowadays, then the cosmic gravitational wave background is actually a parametrically amplified squeeze quantum state, which now has a massive occupation number and become sort of classical, with a roughly scale invariant spectrum. So that means that plots of this against frequency are just straight lines. And it's highly unlikely to have anything like a thermal spectrum like the its analog in microwaves. Now, I want to show us a plot here of signal and some detectors. Just like the ground-based folks have LIGO 1, LIGO 2, and LIGO 3, I'm envisioning some different leases, and I'll tell you about what some of these are later on. One of them is a little bit into the realms of science fiction. It's rather large. Actually, I might as well tell you about it. It actually would orbit in a big circular orbit around the sun out somewhere near Pluto. So it's rather large, and have somewhat improved acceleration performance compared to LISA. One thing that helps it is that out there, one of the main causes of acceleration noise, which is what this line is coming up here in these graphs, is actually due to thermal fluctuations in the solar intensity, but of course that's down by a factor of 1,000 when you're out there. Anyway, this blue line is sort of like about as optimistic as we might be about the signal strength in like a standard inflationary scenario. And if you see something like LISA 2, which is again things around on a circular orbit now but at 1 AU, which is really quite easily doable, you would actually start to get these sort of sensitivities with a single detector to be able to detect something like the cosmic gravitational wave background. But LISA itself, or at least one LISA alone, doesn't look like it could get there. And just to sort of calibrate you on some of the other plots I'm about to show, I'm going to show you the same diagram, but now converted from the familiar strain into this funny omega gravity gravitational wave plot. So here it is. Look at this graph. Here's exactly the same graph, well, now over slightly showing you it over a longer range of frequencies, done in terms of this omega gravity wave parameter. And the H here is actually H naught, the Hubble expansion rate in units of 100 kilometers per second per megaparsec. And again, we see that LISA 2 would be able to make a detection. And one thing to notice here is LISA 3 starts to have some sensitivity down below 10 to the minus 6 hertz, which is going to be important. Why is that important? Well, okay, so it's difficult and rather fanciful to talk about the sorts of instruments that we'd need to build to be able to go after something like the cosmic gravitational wave background, but that's actually not the major challenge. That's just a matter of money and time, right? There's nothing fun. There's no fundamental problem there. If we wait long enough, we can do this, and if we build some better machines, we can do this. The real problem is this. It's all the other stuff in the universe. Like, every time any little piece of mass in the universe moves, it produces a gravitational wave. And even though the individual contributions might not be very strong, when you add up all the contributions due to all the masses and all the binaries, for example, moving around in every galaxy in the universe, then they actually form what also looks like a stochastic background. It's a confusion-limited background, and the central limit theorem tells you it starts to look just like a stochastic background you might expect from something like inflation. And here's this graph due to Rafaela Schneider, and here's some of their estimates for some of these strengths, these background strengths, plotted again in terms of this omega gravity wave. And if you look, here's that same line I was showing you for inflation, and right across all these frequencies here, it sits squarely underneath all of the astrophysical foregrounds, as we might call them in this game, except it does look like astrophysical sources do tend to start dropping out past about once you get down below microhertz. So that might be the place to go to look for these things. At higher frequencies, I think more and more sources just keep on coming in. So just to show you some models other than just plain old inflation, here's some of the sort of fairly toy models that are being considered. And this dotted line is that same graph just showing the envelope for those astrophysical foregrounds. For example, radion fluctuations in M-theory produce a nice big spike in a useful place. We've got various string cosmology models. This is what the analog of a thermal bath would look like. Just to show you how the detectors would go on this sort of thing, I've got an overlay here. And even LISA would have a shot at seeing this M-theory radion excitation model, but I think that model was designed specially for LISA, so that's not really particularly relevant. So one thing we need to do is, one of the problems is that the cosmic gravitational wave background is a stochastic signal, so what we are trying to detect is noise. So if you're detecting this, how do you know that it's the gravitational wave background and not instrument noise? Well, one thing to do is to cross-correlate two detectors, so here might be two LISAs, and because the signal is then correlated, but the noise in each detector would be uncorrelated, the signal-to-noise ratio in the cross-correlated detectors will grow like 1 on root t. This is just the beam pattern you get when you cross-correlate them. For the cross-correlated things, the thing that you see is that the signal-to-noise ratio of the pair of detectors improves relative to that of a single detector as T times delta F, where delta F is the bandpass. For a LIGO pair, that works really well for a one-year integration, because for a bandpass of like 10 to the 3 hertz, that would boost. So if you cross-correlate the two LIGO detectors, this is work that Bruce Allen and others have looked at, you get a big boost in sensitivity of about 2 by 10 to the 5, but at lower frequencies, so once you're down to laser frequencies, the boost isn't really so good. It's down to only about 500. And once you get out to that giant laser 3, where you're getting down to trying to look in the very low frequencies where we think we can actually get past the backgrounds, then the boost is only like a factor of 6. So basically, you need to be able to detect it with one detector because you're not going to get much of a boost. You do all this optimal filtering here, and you work out that the optimal signal-to-noise ratio that you can get integrating over some frequency acceptance range, giving you this band pass, is this. And you can get a signal-to-noise of 1 for something with an orbital radius out of an AU. Acceleration noises, which are about those that are given in the LISA pre-phase A report. So if you actually had a pair of LISA 2s, you would be able to get sort of signal-to-noise to detect sort of our canonical standard sort of inflation model. So it's not out of the question that we can actually detect this. One of the things that we'd then like to go after, and we've got Shane and I have a paper coming out on this next week. We also looked at how well we could measure the anisotropies. And what you do is you use the fact that you take that peanut and you run it around across the sky as it, you know, as your orbit goes around. And it works pretty well for LISA because it has this sort of tumbling motion, cartwheels around the sun. So you really do scan your beam pattern nicely around the sky, and you could make quite a good map of any backgrounds in the frequency ranges for LISA. The only problem is, once you get out and start to try and put them on giant orbits, you know, out around the sun, we've got a little problem with Kepler, because all the frequencies then go very, very small, and you don't basically, your scan rate becomes hundreds of years. So unfortunately, if you want to try and produce a map down in the microhertz kind of ranges, you're just not going to be able to wait long enough to run your beam pattern around. So we have to think about other ideas about how we might be able to make a map of the anisotropies. But just to conclude, I would say that things are very promising as far as future missions being able to actually go out and detect and put a level on the cosmic gravitational wave background. I think that's quite possible. To get a COBE-type map of the anisotropies, that's either going to take some new ideas or even more money. So that's where I'll stop. Thank you.
Question for you, Chris. Like the plots, you're going down the frequency. You're showing it down to 10 to the minus 12 hertz.
The
frequency of that corresponds to an observation time of about 15,000 years, doesn't it?
Oh, those plots, yeah. Well, the plots, the reason I was showing those plots is if you actually go down to 10 to the minus 18 hertz, that's a Hubble frequency, right?
Okay.
And so you're not necessarily going to be doing any detection down there, for example, people... you're really going to have to wait a long time.
That's right.
But for example, at 10 to the minus 9 hertz, using pulsar timing measurements, people can put bounds down there. So you just tend to show the graph
just,
right across the
right,
range.
I just asked because you were continuous with the noise curve. And so that's a little surprising. I'm sorry, so any other questions?
So the CFB people are now planning sort of polarization measurements.
Right.
Hoping to sort of pull out a spin two component fluctuations. So now that's presumably a gravitational wave background that they're going to hope
absolutely.
To see. So how does that sort of
fit in? Okay, so what they'd be seeing there is they'd be from that first graph from the actual COBE sort of anisotropy graph, instead of just having a picture like this of the temperatures, they'd produce a similar map of they'd actually break this. It could be all of these temperatures here are actually due to temperature fluctuations. Component that's causing that. If we have polarizations, we can split the degeneracy by measuring the Stokes parameters as well as just the temperatures. We'll be able to say how much of that temperature, what we're seeing here, is actually due to tensor or scalar perturbations. So that'll actually be a measurement of the gravitational waves, but that's way down at the Hubble-type frequencies, right? So it's measuring them at really, really low frequencies, and if it's not an inflationary spectrum where it's going to be dead flat, if it's one of these sort of M-theory-inspired things where it spikes up just where your detector happens to be, then, the bounds that you might put on from from these future CMB experiments won't necessarily be relevant to the gravitational wave, you know, direct measurements that we try and do. Plus, you're getting a process signal as well. You're seeing the effect of the gravitational waves on the plasma. You're not seeing the gravitational waves themselves. Sorry, is M theory
having this inside the spectrum of such a thing?
If they made a definite prediction, it would be.
So what is that prediction?
Well, that prediction, I mean, these things are, of course, you know, for different parameters. This was just for a particular, where there was some, like, radions, you know, one of the wrapped up dimensions having some kinds of radion turbulence. This was, I think, Craig Hogan, was it, that produced that? But, I mean, there's all sorts of parameters you can vary in. So he produces graphs where he shifts that around in frequency and what sort of amplitude you might expect. But if there was an absolute definite prediction, you know, if M-theory was all figured out and say, well, this is exactly what you're going to see, then this would be a way to go out and, like, test quantum gravity, basically. So if they give us a definite prediction, we'll go out and try and falsify or detect.
I think
there's
not better
than
the death of heaven. Yeah, I'm just kind of curious. Galactic formation or proto-galaxy formation took place pretty fast. Does that add any background noise at all?
People have talked about the collapse of some very early type stars as a very low frequency type of background. I don't know the exact details, but the amplitudes don't look particularly high. But yeah, I mean, like I was saying, anytime mass moves around, it's kicking up some gravitational waves. I don't think that background is particularly significant, but it's something that people have looked at somewhat. But I think there's still a lot of work to be done in trying to characterize what our sort of astrophysical sort of backgrounds are going to be. I've seen lots of different versions of these graphs, and they vary a lot. So there's still a lot of uncertainties in these predictions.
Rod?
The graph you showed of the generated astrophysical background cut off and on microbursts.
Right.
Was that just compact stars? It seemed like it was looking at the picture.
Yeah, it was compact stars, and the last little bump there was actually due to sort of black hole binaries.
Okay, I mean, wouldn't you have stuff extending lower frequencies?
Oh, I think so. There's probably not a huge amount of orbit bump, but this is basically. This line coming down like this is more like no one's actually really looked much further. I wouldn't say for sure that we've got like a desert out here of nothing. I think things are actually starting to fall off. We're looking at that now. But it does look that once you get down below microhertz, things do start to clean out for you a bit. But
from pulsar observations, can I put a... Where would the limit set by pulsar observations fall on the vertical scale?
It comes in, I should have marked it on, but this graph there, you mean lines on it. It looks like this.
Okay.
Right, looks like that there.
Okay.
So it's not. Yeah. It's enough to cause the most serious bound on cosmic streams.
Right. Okay. Okay, great. Thank you, Neil. And.